The opening of Viktor Kosenko's Nocturne Fantasy, played by Margaret Fingerhut. I'm Erica Worth, and welcome to this pianist podcast. Today I am catching up with the British pianist Margaret Fingerhut. Having just released an album called Ukraine, A Piano Portrait, Margaret appears on the cover of the April-May issue of Pianist magazine. That's issue number 143. Nice to meet you, Margaret. Thanks for joining us.
It's just lovely to be here and to see you, Erica.
You're very welcome. And I just want to say, I thought your recital a couple of days ago at the Wigmore Hall was absolutely stunning. It was on the 25th of March, Wigmore Hall, and you played Ukrainian repertoire, which of course is the repertoire that you have on your new album on Somme. It's called Ukraine, A Piano Portrait. So I thought I'd start out by asking you, why go with all this Ukrainian repertoire, especially some that a lot of us have never heard of?
Okay, well, I suppose it's quite a personal thing. My paternal grandfather was born in Odessa. So it was this incredibly musical city. I mean, there must have been something in the water there. But particularly for the Jewish community there, you know, you think of all these names, David Oistrakh, Emil Gilels, Ben Moiseevich, Nathan Milstein. I mean, the list goes on. You know, George Gershwin's parents apparently came from Odessa. Even as I suddenly found out, Bob Dylan's grandparents. So, you know, it's this extremely rich musical heritage that I've obviously always felt very proud of having that link. And my grandfather, well, he did, like so many Jewish people at the turn of the previous century, 20th century, he escaped, he fled to the West seeking a better life. He wanted to go to America, but he couldn't afford the passage. So, hey, he ended up in Manchester as well. And that's where my dad was born. So,
okay. And but how did you come across all this repertoire? Did you know it before? When did you start investigating it?
Well, the one composer, Sergei Bortkevitz, I never know how to pronounce these things. I mean, he's kind of part Polish, obviously. I hope we'll talk about him in a little while. But so he'd always been on my radar for a long time. I mean, he's such a fabulous composer. Okay, you could argue he was composing out of his time. He was very conservative. But I had lots of his music in my library anyway, music library. You know, he's just, I mean, his gift for melody, the poetry, the craftsmanship, his music just zings off the page. Always.
Well, I think you're right.
Particularly in the miniatures.
Yes.
So that's how I came to sort of start. That was my starting point. And, you know, with everything that's going on, bringing Ukraine to the forefront of people's minds and hearts at the moment. So I started to think, as I always do, you know, well, what other repertoire is out? What is Ukrainian repertoire? You know, as opposed to, obviously, it's all very complicated. Mm. So that's what started my exploration. It was just eye-opening for me, or I should say ear-opening.
Yes, yes.
I just fell in love with so much of it. And I just thought, I have to record some of this music. I have to play it. So,
yes. It was ear-opening for us as well at the Wigmore. And in fact, as you talked about Bortkiewicz, as your encore, you did the Constellation, Opus 17, number 4, which I so much loved. We have the sheet music in the current issue, on which you'll cover. That's such an amazing piece. I mean, as you say, so melodic.
I'm so happy you picked that one out of, I mean, do I have any personal favourites? No, they're all my favourites.
Yes, yes.
This one, as I did at the Wigmore, it makes such a beautiful encore piece as well. Mm. Mm. I mean, you know, sometimes I played it and there's literally not a dry eye in the house. It's just so effecting. And in.
I know. And what's amazing, Margaret, I have to say, is this Ukrainian repertoire that you're playing, that you've discovered, it's very, a lot of it is very heartbreaking. It's very from the heart. I mean, it yearning, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, how does one explain that with the Slavic temperament that's always quite dark? And I mean, so many of these composers had such difficulties in their lives, the struggle, the hardships they endured. I mean, can one say that's what informed their playing? How who knows? But it's really just, I mean, for that hyper emotion that comes across in all this music, it's just so fabulous.
And you say the father, I think at the recital, which I so enjoyed listening to you because you speak in between the pieces, which was lovely. I'd like to get back to that. But you said, I think you said the father of Ukrainian composers was Lysenko, Lysenko.
I don't know. It's terrible that I don't speak Ukrainian to be able to pronounce everything correctly. So any listeners out there who are chatting,
Lysenko.
I think it's Lysenko. I don't know. Lysenko, you with a anyway.
Tell us a bit about him then, for somebody who knows nothing about Lysenko.
Yeah, well, as you say, the father of Ukrainian music, because he was really the first composer to actually kind of strive for a national music identity. Now, even he got into trouble with the authorities, the Russian back then, the Russian authorities, was trying to promote Ukrainian language, Ukrainian culture. I think he was even imprisoned for a while for doing all these things. And he also became very involved in the Dumka, as one of the pieces on my CD, the beautifully named Dumka Shumka.
Yes, I love that name.
It's great fun, that's kind of great fun, that piece. But other pieces of his are these little miniatures, which I think you featured before in
Yes.
your
Well, I think we
Matthew
featured Angoise, which means
Angers,
anguish.
anguish, literally. Yes, the moment désespoir, moment of, yeah. I mean, they were actually interesting. Both those pieces were on my short list, long list, or whatever. When I was trying to decide what to, how to put together everything, I would have loved to have included them in my CD, but there
It's a
wasn't.
lot.
They are absolutely heartbreaking. And it's interesting, like Lysenko, one of his pieces is a choir. Sort of, it's a prayer for Ukraine. He originally said it's the words of Ukrainian poet, I forget which one, but it's become literally the universal prayer for you. It's like the national anthem of Ukraine. If you,
Amazing.
and it's it features in all sorts of different arrangements. You can get your listeners could probably find a piano version of it as well, which I'm sure would be worth exploring. So it's just one wonderful
Fantastic.
iconic piece of music in Ukraine.
Wow. Okay. I mean, and another piece that I think touched a lot of people in the audience, myself included, was Kosenko's Nocturne Fantasy Opus 4. Very Scriabin-esque, would
Wow.
you
And how, yes, as
say?
well. A very well, sensuous, exotic kind of perfumed flavor. This is extraordinary. I mean, for me, I couldn't, when I started to play the piece, and I thought, oh, this is very Scriabin-esque, whatever. But I couldn't get it out of my mind. It literally came to sort of haunt me in my dream. This obsessive figure, you heard it, and it reprises it at the end. This is immense climax. I mean, I got that. Well, that piece alone just contains thousands of notes, but it's just so wonderful. This huge, like Rachmaninoff type climax in the middle, but not Rachmaninoff. It was just extraordinary. It just literally haunted me. So I just had to play that.
Oh, I'm so glad. But then on the other edge of the spectrum, you had the Three Bagatelles by Silvestrov. Totally simple compared to that, but heartbreaking again. Tell us a bit about these pieces.
Yeah, well, I've been playing them quite a lot recently, and I've often had people come up out from the audience afterwards who are keen pianists of differing levels, or whatever, and they go, "Where can I find the music? You know, it sounds like it's within my capabilities because it sounds so simple, but so intense yet very emotional." I mean, this composer, he also had a fascinating journey because he started off life in an ultra-modernist style, you know, really impenetrable, complex, atonal music. And then he literally rebelled against it all. He abandoned it all. He came back to write all these. I mean, I don't know how many bagatelles he wrote, but definitely worth seeking out. But with a caveat, when I first got the score, I don't think I've ever seen music so highly notated as his, this very, very simple, very linear writing, but every single note, almost every single note individually has a different dynamic on it. Every bar has different tempi mark. I mean, the first bagatelle particularly, and you know, this rubati, this rallentando, accelerando, like literally within one note. And it literally did my head in. I mean, I just went absolutely mad trying to, as one does, faithfully try and get under the composer's skin to find out, you know, what's a, you know, as one does with any score, Beethoven, whatever, you're like a detective. What has the composer, the markings that the composer, what did he put there, and what does it, what clues does it offer as to the interpretation? But I would literally, my head was spinning. So I listened to other pianists play it because it has been adopted. He's become a little bit of a cult figure. He's still alive. He's age 88 now, living in Berlin. He fled Kyiv, where he was living. He fled in 2022. I said people are kind of slightly, you know, flocking to him. It's music, spirituality to it. It's the zeitgeist sort of that. So I started to listen to these other recordings, and I realized that everyone was doing not what he said remotely. Even you know, people that had obviously had contact with him, and I heard a recording of his playing this music. It's recording with the lid shut because everything is pianissimo, these whispering melodies that are sort of, you know, all this faded kind of nostalgia he conjures up. And his own recording, which is of an earlier version of the bagatelles, obviously, but he doesn't do anything that's in the score either. So having had that sort of take a deep breath, I've studied all this, tried to get behind every single note. Now just relax, and you just have to play it.
Yeah, because it has to have that improvisatory kind of dreamlike feeling.
So but it really, I mean, it captures this stillness. Well, I hope you that's the
I mean, those pieces,
across the
I love the first one and the second one. Both of those. Oh, I think readers or listeners should definitely sound them out for us.
Yes, with that caveat, you know, when
Yeah, even if they don't,
you get them, obviously you can buy the music, but with that caveat,
Of
don't
course.
be put off by what he
Yeah.
tries to.
Yeah.
And
I think I'm a bit put off
I'd
now.
love to have, you know, I wish I could. Part of me wishes, I'd love to go to Berlin and meet him, and you know, and try and sort of say what, you know, try and understand it. But be that as it may, you have to. It's like with anything, when you try and follow the composer's intentions as best you can, but ultimately you have to own the piece yourself.
Yes, of course.
It's you playing it. You.
Absolutely. And with regards to your own playing, all this repertoire, what has it taught you about your own playing? What might it have? Anything new? Anything new?
Anything about my own playing? That's a tricky one in this repertoire specific. I suppose one of the things is, because so many of the pieces on the, well, they all are, they're all miniatures of varying length. So It's the challenge of how do you immediately bring a sense of narrative to a short piece of music. If you like, it's say an author writing a long novel,
yeah,
or a short story, and within that short story, you've got to convey the mood, the character, the atmosphere, and it's getting to the trying to get straight away that sense. I mean, everything, every piece of music, be it Beethoven sonata or whatever, the huge. That there is a sense of, that's what I'm always trying to do. So this, I found some of them quite, challenging, but it's always getting to the essence of.
Yes, little miniature. That's so interesting. I mean, in your interview for Pianist magazine, you talk about struggles, having gone through struggles, maybe with your playing, and so many pianists pretend or musicians pretend they're invincible, that no technical issues. What kind of struggles might you wish to confide with us?
Well, actually, it's not even confiding, because I think a few years ago I wrote to you about one of the problems. I had a really bad intractable frozen shoulder, my right shoulder. Yeah. So I couldn't play for almost 2 years. So I, in the end, I had to have an operation. And but I think I wrote an article for your magazine about left-handed repertoire, and that again opened up a world for me. But there we are. I was owning up. Maybe it I was brave enough to own up to the fact, after I'd come back, as it were, because you never like to go, did you hear about Margaret? She can't play anymore, sort of thing.
Yeah,
and that is a tough thing. And I've had other problems since then.
Yeah,
physical problems kind of connected with the whole thing. I've had a trigger finger, Dupuytren's, all sorts. And I always sort of joke, well, I've had more comebacks than hot dinners, sort of thing. But anyway, here I am. I'm still playing.
Yes. Oh, that's so interesting. I love one of the quotes you said, your teacher, Cyril Smith. And you say to me, you said in the quote, Cyril Smith told me that you have to memorize your left hand so that if your right hand was indisposed, your left hand could still give the concert. That's remarkable.
It's an amazing quote. But it's not just about helping you to memorize or it's about understanding the structure of the piece, because it all comes from the left hand upwards, and it's often where the character that lies. If you hear a really good string quartet playing,
yes,
so say it's Mozart or Haydn, whatever, and you listen to a cellist or whatever, it's a very simple part, but the difference, the life, the spirit, the energy, the rhythmic energy, what really makes it can. I mean, if I will say, look, famously, the Chopin etudes.
Yes.
Most of them are, we call, right hand etudes. The right hand has all the phenomenal technical difficulty, and your student will tend to focus on, practice that endlessly.
Yes.
But actually, really, I always think the difference between, say, a good performance and a great performance is the character of the left hand, because that's where the character lies in you. There's so many of the etudes.
How interesting. I'm going to listen to your recording again after this and really focus in on your hand.
I drive my students nuts. Something's going wrong, something's boring and everything, and I go, play your left hand. They know I'm going to do it. I don't know why they don't prepare properly. Play your left hand. Can you play your left hand here from memory, please? And they play it, and I go, but that's, that's really boring, or you don't know where the harmony is. You've got to build it up. I'm always taking pieces apart, and especially looking at my left hands.
And do you think that's because of your The injury that you had.
No, it's always been. That's from Cyril. One of the things from Cyril, but I'm, you know, other coaches who've inspired me, Leon Fleischer, and you know, Natasha Perlmutter. I've been very lucky with my teachers to have been inspired by some very great.
Did you have lessons?
Yes. I was a postgraduate. I went to Peabody for a year. So that's that was an amazing time.
Amazing. Oh, well, I'm gonna branch off a bit and get a bit lighthearted here. not that we are, you know, anything but having a I'm gonna ask you some little short questions, which I like to ask, and you know, they're interesting. Responses can be interesting. So the first one, if you could play only one piece from now on, what would it be?
Yeah, that's such a horrible question.
I know, it's mad.
It's like, you know, Desert Island Disc or something. No, I can't be without X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Okay. In lockdown, one of my projects was to learn the 48, you know, Bach 48. There's always so many people say this, but I just got so much nourishment on so many levels from it. And I didn't quite get to the end of the second book, so I think there's kind of unfinished work there. So, but I'd love to, that would be my one piece. I mean, aside from the obvious technical, intellectual challenges, everything, there's a Prelude and Fugue for every mood. You know, I was talking about this sense of narrative, always telling a story. In Bach, you tell a story as well.
Yeah.
Each one of the 48 has its own world, its own character, and you can just get. Yeah. There's something piece to suit every mood. You know, you've got joy and dancing, everything, and then you've got deep despair, you know, profound grief. You've got cheeky humor. You've just got everything there. So I think that
that's a very, very clever answer. And going on to the next question, then, you might, if you could play only one composer from now on, who would it be?
Now, that's an equally horrible question.
Not Bach?
No, Chopin, I think. Oh. It would be. And it's partly a personal thing from my upbringing, shall we say. My first piano teacher gave me lots of, you know, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, lots of British music to play, which has kind of kindled my love of British music. But he wouldn't allow me to play any Chopin. He said, he kept saying, no, I kept begging him to go, no, you're too young. Wait till you're grown up, sort of, you're more grown up than everything. But what he didn't know was my mum, who was a keen amateur pianist, had all his Chopin's music at home. So I used to, anyway, go home and just play all the waltzes and mazurkas and nocturnes and everything. So I grew up thinking, well, there's something a little bit special and sacred about Chopin. So it was almost not quite forbidden fruits, but anyway, and I think that has stayed with me on a certain level.
I think that's a lovely answer. I get it. Next one pianist, dead or alive, you would travel long and far to hear?
Rubinstein. I actually did hear him live a couple of times when I was, you know, younger. So
What was it about his playing?
Well, you know, it's this very direct playing. You know, when you think he's not doing anything with the music because it sounds just so natural. He doesn't seem to, you know, pull them in. But when you start to analyze it, as I have, you know, you put on a recording and think, well, what is it? What makes this so special? Because it's so almost artless, it seems. But they're all, and it's extraordinary the subtle things he does. The nobility, the joie de vivre, just on so many levels. I mean, so many pianists.
I understand.
Far, but you did again. You're quite a brute here. You asked for only one.
I'm sorry. Don't have time to ask for three. Another question. Any technical issues? Do you have any technical issues?
How long have we got?
Oh dear. Well, okay, it might give listeners hope if they have this.
All right. Okay. Double notes, especially sixths, because I have, you know, see, yeah, your listeners can't see. I'm holding up my little small hands here to say, oh my gosh, you've got such small hands. And I also tremble before tremolando, so I'm not, you know.
Oh.
The patatique always caused me, when I was growing up, I don't know, you've really got to. Those are the
things,
hey, you know.
Interesting.
Do my best.
Things are horrendous, as are thirds, but maybe, oh dear.
Oh, thirds, not so bad. third on the list after six and tremor.
Okay. And any advice you would give to an amateur pianist on how to improve?
Well, one of my big things is how to practice properly. You know, so many people kind of just play things through, you know, and I'm a big fan of what I call micro practicing.
Yeah.
You know, so you sort of bite-sized portion, you know, if you've only got 5 minutes, 10 minutes, go for even just one bar.
Yeah.
So you feel, you know, and so take it apart, you know, focus on what are the problems here? You know, and so it really gets into your mind. And then you incorporate it into the sort of bigger picture. Obviously, you can't just do these micro practices. Oh. But that's what I love. When I work with students and we look at something that's causing them a problem and I help them to take it apart and think, right, does this work? Does that work? Just try playing these four notes. Let's see, you know, that the hand movement, or, you know, what the fingering, whatever.
Yes.
And I love seeing that light bulb moment. That gives me so much joy as a teaching this.
Ah, fascinating. If you weren't a pianist, what would you be?
Rich. I'm married to someone who's worked in business, so I'm okay, but
No other professions you thought about when you were young?
Particularly previously, I've moved house so many times in the course of my life for various reasons. So I've been involved in so many renovations, redecorations, and I love working with. I've never really worked, you know, I've always done it myself and kind of, you know, tried to. I love the concept of working with a space, how to design something both, you know, aesthetic and practical. And, you know, I've had very small kitchens in my life, and I love the challenge of how to organize. I'm great at organizing. You could say I use the, you know, procrastination to kind of go, oh, my, you know, my kitchen drawers need reorganizing. possibly practice this morning. You know how it is. But I love, you know, what can fit where. And also the sense of satisfaction when you do a design project. It's like, and you see the finished product, whereas music's so nebulous. You know, you practice something one day, you might improve it, but then it's going to go somewhere else the next day. And
well, isn't that what's it? But surely that's what's great about recordings in a way, because they're there.
Yes. But I often wonder about the creative process, you know, how does a writer or an artist decide when when this is done, they'll stop fiddling, you know, changing a word here or a little dab of paint there, you know, how can they ever decide?
Yes,
it's done. This is how it, and a recording is, although it is it's a snapshot of how you're playing something at the moment, but it is a bit more. You're quite right. It is something. There is a document that's out there, permanence, which is slightly scary.
because
instantly, the very next day, I the thing I hate most of all is listening back to my record, so I never listen back.
I can understand that. I can totally get that.
Yeah, but you know, with a, I said with a passage of time, you know, there, I know there've been like recordings or whatever when I've not been at all happy.
And,
And remember what you and you go, no, I'm never going to listen to that. I hated it at the time when you have to edit it and you're going, oh my gosh, this is absolutely terrible. And I can remember just a couple of years ago, you know, walking to my husband's study and he had the radio on or something. And it was a piece of music that I played and recorded. And I remember listening to it and thinking, wow, that's really good. Yeah. Oh, and then you're going, oh, I wish I could play as well as that. And then discovering it was this recording that you were.
Amazing. So you can surprise
yourself. So with the passage of time.
Yes.
You kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think my last question to you is one composer you're not quite ready for.
Oh, Busoni.
Wow.
Okay. I mean, I did. Well, I remember years ago, I was once asked to record an etude, a theme and variations or something for the BBC. And I mean, I did my best, but it didn't really kind of speak to me. I mean, yeah. I mean, having said that, you know, I really enjoy, I've taught his Chaconne,
yes.
But I don't really quite yet kind of connect to it.
Mm.
Mind you, having said that, you know, I have played and recorded Kenneth Leighton's Fantasia Contrapuntistica, which I really enjoyed. But I mean, that's nothing if not, you know, in the Busoni. It started with Busoni, so maybe, I don't know, maybe I am ready for Busoni. I don't know.
Now, there's so much repertoire out there that you just can't cover everything. And as you said in your interview, it's so important for you that you approach and learn repertoire that means something to you.
Really, that's the key thing. I mean, we pianists, we're so blessed or cursed. There's a vast amount of repertoire out there. Just pick something, be it a Haydn sonata or whatever music, or you know, a little miniature or whatever, something that really speaks to you.
And you're always discovering, aren't you? Always.
Always, yeah.
Oh, well, Margaret, listen, I think we've come to the end. But, I mean, it's been a pleasure. What's next? What are you doing now? You've done your recording. You've done your big Wigmore Hall concert.
Yes, just off to Tuscany to go walking. That's one of the things I love to do as an antidote
in my
life. So walking and eating. And then I'm back into the thick of it. I've got an interesting program I'm coming up with for a concert at the British Library in May. So, new challenges, always new challenges.
Oh, well, that sounds great. You know, I hope you have a lovely break. Lots of walking and eating sounds wonderful. And thank you so much for joining me today on this podcast, Margaret.
It's been a real pleasure chatting with you, Erica. So, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. That was an excerpt from Viktor Kosenko's Nocturne Fantasy, and it was played by Margaret Fingerhut on her new album, Ukraine, A Piano Portrait, from SOM Recordings. Pianist podcasts are free, and a really good way to support what we do is by subscribing to Pianist. Visit our website at pianistmagazine.com and listen to us on YouTube by searching Pianist Magazine.